Gnosticism, the 24th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 22, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I want to interject a conversation about Gnosticism, then we'll come back to the notes on the early church fathers next week and finish up there. If we don't finish those, at least you've got notes on that, but I promised that I would talk about Gnosticism, and so I want to keep that promise. Okay, so what is Gnosticism? Spelled this way, by the way, G-N-O-S-T-I-C-I-S-M. It comes from the Greek word gnosis, and don't ask me why you would have a word like gnosis, but they do. Yeah, and it's a word, one of the words for knowledge. That's where we get the word agnosticism. Yeah, I not know. Now, you're going to recognize a lot of similarities, a lot of parallels between Gnosticism and Neoplatonism, because Gnosticism is just one more of the phenomena out of this syncretistic mix, this syncretistic milieu that is going on in late antiquity. It's just one more. Now, the difference is it is also taking elements from what are called the mystery religions. Did I talk about the mystery religions in here? Torah bullion, you dig a pit and you sit in the pit, have a grate over it, they slaughter a bull above you and the blood drips down on you, and it gives you either eternal life or 7 years, depending upon the particular mystery religion. That and other kinds of rituals that and the mystery religions were called that because they tended to have secrets that were shared by the initiates into that religion and were not to be shared outside of the religion. That's where the idea of a mystery comes in, a secret that is kept within the confines of the initiates in the religion. Well, Gnosticism is like that. And so it's obviously has a lot of parallels with several mystery religions, but it also has imbibed a whole boatload of assumptions from Neoplatonism. Now, when you talk about Gnosticism, there must be dozens of different kinds of Gnosticism. So basically, Gnosticism is a kind of movement, it's an umbrella term that captures a lot of different religious ideas, and they vary among themselves one from another. So it would be tedious to go through all the different variations of Gnosticism. So what I'm going to do is kind of to trot out a typical, kind of a paradigmatic Gnostic religious position. And I don't know enough to know if I'm getting the details of a particular teacher right. So this is not any particular, this may not actually have existed in the form in which I'm going to present it, but it's a good paradigm for all the Gnostic teachers and what they taught and what they practiced. Is that clear? So I'm not claiming to speak for any given Gnostic teacher. Basically, the overall worldview of the Gnostic is matter is evil and spirit is good. The invisible, the intangible, the immaterial, the stuff of the mind is good. The physical, the material, the stuff of the world is evil. And so they are Pythagorean in that sense and to the nth degree. I mean, you can't get more the spirit-material dichotomy than you do in Gnosticism. Material just is inherently and intrinsically evil. Then they tell a story. They tell a story of a kind of fall and redemption. Now, you have some of that in Neoplatonism. Remember the existence of the world is a falling away from the One, a falling away from being. And as you fall away from being, you become physical, material, and evil with that. So Neoplatonism would be enough to explain this, but the particular form that it takes in Gnosticism suggests pretty strongly that it's been influenced by Christianity. So these Gnostics know about the Christian gospel and are kind of mimicking the gospel story of redemption in Jesus through in the story they tell. They have a pantheon of gods, and so there's the One, or the Light. They will often call the One the Light. And then you have inferior gods to the Light. Sophia is usually one of them. Sophia is wisdom, but that's one of the lower gods, lesser gods. And oftentimes Sophia is the culprit in their system. One of the gods decided to create the human beings. And I don't remember exactly why that was problematic, but that was a problem with some of the gods. And then one of two things happens in a Gnostic religion. Either in order to salvage this really bad thing that the creation was going to bring about, because remember, what you're creating is evil. It's matter. It's physical stuff. So in order to somehow leave open the possibility of redemption, one of the other gods planted a part of the Light within the being of human beings that were being created. So a human being is a evil material shell imprisoning a good, pure piece of Light within it. Others don't make it an act of redemption, but they make it a negative act by the Creator, that this was some kind of act of rebellion and was attempting to take part of the Light and keep it away from being reabsorbed back into the One. And the way they did that is to imprison it in human beings. So I think that's a different variation. But they all result in the same state. Human beings are material, physical beings who are the prison houses of pieces of the Light. And the Light is the good, the One, the true divinity, and so on. So part of divinity is trapped in us human beings. Now, typically in Gnosticism, there are three kinds. I guess it's just two kinds of human beings. There are human beings who do have some of the Light trapped in them, but there are also human beings who are just they're the same shell, but there is no Light trapped in them. And the distinction they make is the ones with Light trapped in them are the pneumatikoi, and those who do not have Light trapped in them are the sarkikoi, I believe they call it. They are just merely flesh in the pneumatikoi, but it comes from sarks, which means flesh. Okay. So we human beings, according to the Gnostic story, some of us are pneumatikoi, some of us are sarkikoi, maybe it's sarkikoi, some of us are sarksikoi, but none of us have a clue. We all of us lack gnosis. None of us have gnosis. Now, what is this knowledge? There's two things that gnosis means in Gnosticism. The first one is, I have to become enlightened to know that I have Light trapped within me. I wouldn't have any way of knowing that unless someone revealed that to me, informed me, taught me that. I wouldn't have any way of knowing that. Now, some of us don't have Light trapped within us. So it's the job of a Gnostic teacher to bring that knowledge to mankind, and those people who do have the Light within them are going to respond. They're going to hear that, they're going to receive that knowledge and accept and embrace that knowledge, and now they know who they are. They are in truth pieces of the Light, separated from the One, separated from the Light, and they need to return to the light and be reabsorbed into the light. That's their concept of salvation. Salvation is for the light within me to ascend through the heavens back to the true light and be reunited and reabsorbed back into the light itself. And that's just is their concept of salvation. The Gnostic teacher proclaims that and tells them that that's the case. They're not even going to respond to it if they are not pneumatikoi. But if they are pneumatikoi, then they're going to respond positively to that and will embrace it. Mm-hmm. Right. One of the Gnostic teachers, who is basically a kind of a cult leader, because he forms a little esoteric group of disciples around him. And they have joined that because they have responded to his call, to his message. Now, where did the Gnostic teacher get that? The origination of that knowledge came from, and here's where you have a kind of Christ figure in Gnosticism. What do they call it? Man. There's an adjective though, the true man. I've lost it, but the true man is sent into the world. The gods have sent the true man into the world to inform all of mankind about this situation that we're in. So a Gnostic teacher is just reporting to you what this man said. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. Not the man. It's a weird title. But whoever this man is, this man comes into the world. He's the prophet, the enlightener, who comes into the world from the gods, from the light, from the true light, in order to inform us of the situation. Okay, so now I know. Now I know who I am. Now I can focus my life on the light within me returning to the light. And how do I live in the meantime? Well, it depends on the Gnostic teachers. Some Gnostic teachers would say, well, your flesh is evil. You're being evil. It just does evil things. So being an evil flesh that does evil things, just have at it. Be evil. Live licentious, immoral, profligate life. I mean, that's what's a body to do. That's what bodies do. So just have at it. That's one flavor of Gnosticism. Very, very, very libertine and licentious. Because you're only going to be liberated at death. So you're just getting prepared to be liberated upon your death. But in the meantime, just do what a sinful body's going to do. The other flavor of Gnosticism is highly ascetic. You beat your body into shape and you don't dare let it follow its passions because it's fundamentally evil and you want to train yourself, prepare yourself for the light and don't let your body distract you in any way. So that's the other flavor of Gnosticism. So that's how...
Second flavor of Gnosticism, that is beat your body into shape, does part of that include abstaining from all sexuality?
Yes.
You're probably going to say something different, and this is somewhat of an off-topic, but in the New American Standard Bible, typically the introduction, with 1 John is talking against Gnosticism. I think you've said in the past that Gnosticism is not what John had in mind, but right. But anyway, if he did, the kind that he would take issue with would be the first kind you mentioned.
Yeah, in all likelihood, yeah. But don't let me not get back to that, but let me save that to the end. But let me address that at the end about the relationship of Gnosticism in the New Testament.
Okay,
so we live our life however the Gnostic teacher tells you to live your life, and that's going to vary from teacher to teacher. What we're really aiming at is upon death, the light within me, the spirit within me, is going to be released from the prison house of the body. And now what's going to happen? Where is it going to go? Well, I want to get back to the light. But here's the problem, and the number is going to depend on the particular Gnostic system. But the world is surrounded by some X number of spheres. As you pass through the heavens, you go from one sphere to the next sphere to the next sphere to the next sphere. And let's say nine spheres. Each of those spheres is ruled, or there should be a light on if it's on. And each sphere is ruled by an archon, a governor, a ruler of that sphere. And that archon is not going to let you pass through his sphere unless you know the password. So like Billy Goat Gruff kind of thing, the troll under the bridge. He's not going to let you pass through the sphere unless you know the password. So where are you going to get the passwords? That's what your Gnostic teacher is for. You pay him the big bucks, and he teaches you the passwords that are going to allow you upon your death to use those as the leave to be able to go through all these various spheres and pass beyond all the spheres where the light within you will be reunited with the light, reabsorbed into the light. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like it, doesn't it? No, I'm not. I'm not. And there are, you know, dozens of different varieties of this. What if we ever get to Augustine, Augustine, before he became a Neoplatonist, was a Manichae. And Mani was a Persian who had a form of Gnosticism that he taught. So Augustine was a Gnostic before he became a Neoplatonist, before he became a Christian. Now, there are Christian Gnostics, and what I mean by Christian Gnostics is there are Gnostics who make a role for Jesus. They make Jesus this, I wish I could remember the name. Not man-man, not er-man, not savior-man, not sinner-man. Can't remember what it is. But they cast Jesus in that role. And they are inclined to look at two gods in the Bible. The God of Genesis is an evil God. He's a bad guy. So when God created the heavens and the earth, that was not a good thing. That was a bad thing that he did. And the God who did that is a bad God. Yahweh is a bad God. But beyond him is the true God, the one God, the light. And that's who Jesus comes from, descends from, in order to bring redemption and salvation by enlightening us, bringing us the gnosis. By the way, I said there were two things. So the gnosis is knowing that you have light within you and knowing the passwords that are going to allow you to. That's what constitutes the gnosis of Gnosticism. Okay, couple questions then. The relationship between Gnosticism and the New Testament on the one hand, and the relationship between Gnosticism and the gospel. And Gnosticism as it's used oftentimes by Christian thinkers today, what are they talking about? What are they getting at? Let's talk about that first. I went to a talk once not too long ago where a guy was bad-mouthing people who believe kind of what I believe because it is Gnostic. And what he was getting at is any time you throw the emphasis in our faith onto knowledge and understanding, theology, doctrine, and give that any kind of significant decisive, make that of any decisive import in your faith, then people of his ilk are going to accuse you of being a Gnostic. You're saying that we're saved by knowledge. Because you believe we're saved by knowledge, you are a Gnostic. Well, okay, first of all, there's something very misleading about that. Sometimes the only thing we know is that Gnosticism is bad. They were considered heretics by the early church, and they were the arch enemy of the early church. And we know that being Gnostic is bad. So Gnostic is a four-letter word in Christian history. So to accuse someone like me of being a Gnostic is to already prejudice them against my position, because that obviously that can't be good. But notice, The Gnosticism that, if anything, deserves that kind of approbation against it is this silly stuff that I've just been articulating. To call me a Gnostic in that sense would be ridiculous. I mean, of course I don't believe in passwords and archons and being reabsorbed into the light and the complete obliteration of my human identity as salvation. You know, of course I don't believe that. There's nothing at all in what I believe that's anywhere remotely like the Gnosticism of history that got the kind of reputation that it got. So the only thing that my view and Gnosticism could possibly hold in common is that we both make room for knowledge, you know, that there's a place for knowledge in our systems, but that is a very weak connection between me and Gnosticism. So you following that? If what he means by calling me a Gnostic is that I believe knowledge has some very, very decisive role to play in faith, then guilty is charged, as is every apostle who wrote in the New Testament. Paul wrote, in Christ are all the treasures of wisdom and understanding. He talks about the knowledge of God and the knowledge of our Savior. You could find, I mean, every other page in the New Testament is talking about the gospel of Jesus coming into the world to bring us knowledge and understanding. So if that's what we mean by Gnosticism, then I'll fess up. Sure, I'm a Gnostic just like the apostles are, because they're the ones that taught me.
I'm going to take issue with you and defend you.
Okay, take issue with me and defend me.
In Gnosticism, you're saved by knowledge, mm-hmm. right? All those verses you mentioned, is that just not a product of the fact that you have been saved, are being saved? It's not a way of salvation, but it's just a product that just comes along with it.
So yeah, some of them might be, but to the extent that I would argue that to the extent that we're saved by faith, what is faith except knowledge? So to the extent that we're saved by faith, I would say we are saved by knowledge. Now that's a complicated picture, as anyone who's heard me talk about the gospel, are we saved by faith? Well, yeah, but only as a symptom of what really saves us. It's not really salvation by knowledge, because it's knowledge. And yeah, that would make me different.
I'm going to defend you too, but it's going to be weird. I don't know. If you take the Pauline corpus seriously, I think that a lot of the Gnostic cosmology, a lot of what you just described, could be found in the Pauline corpus, maybe not in the Synoptic Gospels, but in the epistles that are attributed to Paul. For instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul talks about the pneumatikoi and the sarkatikoi. Mm-hmm. And for the Gnostics, the idea of the archons of this age is a big idea. And in that very same chapter where Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about the pneumatikoi and the sarkatikoi, he talks about the archons of this age who have crucified Christ. Similarly, the pleroma is a big deal in Gnosticism, and Paul makes a big deal about this idea of the pleroma being in Christ. When Paul talks there in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, he sounds a lot like the Gnostic revealer who shares wisdom, secret wisdom and knowledge of Christ to these believers. God opens their eyes because they are the pneumatikoi and not the sarkatikoi. Just like in Gnosticism, if you're the sarkatikoi, you're not going to get it because you're of the flesh. But for Paul, if you are the pneumatikoi, you will get it. So Gnosticism, I think there's something syncretistic already happening in the New Testament. And if you take the New Testament seriously, then your theology, I think, is going to be a little bit syncretistic between Gnosticism and Judaism and Christianity. So,
okay. Read a book called Pre-Christian Gnosticism by, I think it's Yamaguchi is his last name. That's where I first got exposed to that. The argument about Gnosticism affecting the New Testament comes, Bultmann was a big proponent of that. The problem is that Bultmann has to posit an existence of Gnosticism before Gnosticism actually existed in history. Because all the people that we're talking about post-date Christianity. So when you get the pneumatikoi and the sarkikoi, as Paul does, Paul didn't get it from them. They got it from him. He defined it They've reinterpreted it. They've recontextualized it into their system and their worldview. But they've just taken language that probably they lifted from Paul. Because pneumatikoi is not a word that is at home within their cosmology. It's very much at home in Paul's system. It's a weird word for them to use for the people who have the light in them. Why not phosikoi? I mean, that would make more sense in their system. Why not that? Because I think they are imitating and copying Paul, I would think. So I think it's the reverse. The Gnostics are what's the word, riffing on Paul rather than Paul riffing on them. In something like Colossians, Paul, and that's where we have to be really careful, and a lot of New Testament scholars are just tone deaf to this problem. You can't decide that there is a interdependence or a relationship between system A and system B just because they use the same words. It makes all the difference in the world what that system means by those words. And I would argue what the Gnostics mean by pleroma and what Paul means by pleroma are not even close to each other. They're not even related to each other. Entirely different concepts. What Paul is talking about by the archon is not what the Gnostics are talking about as the archon. What was the other one you mentioned?
I mentioned 2 Corinthians 2, the pleroma in Colossians, and also in 2 Corinthians 2, I talked about the archons of this age.
Yeah,
I'm aware of the debate as to whether or not Gnosticism preceded Christianity. I think I fall more on the side that Gnosticism did exist before Christianity, but that's not totally relevant to what I was saying, because a lot of these ideas, like the principalities and powers that rule in the air in Ephesians, and that are in work inside of the unbelievers, causing them to do the wicked things that they're doing, that he talks about these archons, these rulers in the air.
You're talking about Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah, but look how you're interpreting him. Is that what he meant?
The principalities and powers that are in the air that are spiritually at work in unbelievers.
Making them do what they do.
I think that's a side implication that's not really totally relevant to my point. But
okay.
The idea that there are these beings in the heavens that are these principalities and powers, that are these archons. This is why Gnostics loved Paul. This is why Gnostics said, Paul's our guy. They didn't love the Synoptics. They loved Paul. Some of them loved John. That's why. Because there's a strong relationship, I think.
So. Well, there will always be a strong relationship if I rip somebody off, change the meaning of all of his concepts, his vocabulary, give it new meaning. I can always claim myself a disciple and a devotee of that person. But I'm not saying the same thing at all, not even close.
Yeah, granted, I doubt that Ephesians is even written by Paul. I think it's just in the name of Paul. But that it talks about these principalities and powers in that context, I think it's hard. I mean, don't you think it is talking about these heavenly rulers?
No, I don't.
That's strange. I don't know. Why don't you think it's talking about heavenly rulers?
What, you mean in the spiritual warfare passage?
When he talks about principalities and powers,
our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Is that the one you're?
No, it's a couple. The rulers of the darkness of this age, it's there, but also earlier in Ephesians, he talks about these things that are ruling in the heavens. And I think that he talks about them as principalities and powers there too.
I think there are contexts where the rulers in the heavenlies are probably rabbis. It's these people who are the teachers and rulers and governors of our life, and it's not in the heavenlies, it's with respect to heavenly things. So the people who are governing us, ruling over us with respect to heavenly things, are rabbi types who are encouraging us to keep the law. That's what's going on in Colossians, I think. Because that's the argument of Colossians. Its home is not in Gnostic cosmology. Its home is in battling incipient legalism among these Gentile believers who don't know better because you know, they used to be pagans, not Jews, and these Jews are coming along and making a case for, okay, now that's great that you believe in Jesus, but what would Jesus have us do? Well, if it was good enough for Moses, it was good enough for Jesus, and so let's go back and do that. And that's the debate, that's the issue, that's the concern in Colossians. It has nothing to do with anything like returning to the light on the other side of the cosmos that the Gnostics are talking about. They've totally transformed Paul's vocabulary into something completely alien to what Paul is interested in, I would argue.
Yeah, I mean, granted that I think the Gnostic cosmology is a little bit more primitive in the New Testament. But in Colossians, he does talk about warning against the worshiping of the angeloi and things like this. So I don't, this is probably a different issue, but I don't know that.
The angeloi there, I think, are the scriptures.
The scriptures are the angels.
Don't worship the text.
Don't worship the text. Man, I don't want to take up the whole time, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long, long discussion.
Because that sounds like rationalization to me, just making it more rational than it is. But
pre-Christian Gnosticism, it's probably out of print, so you have to get a used copy. But yeah, I think it's Yamaguchi, something like that. And he basically is taking on that whole issue of where Gnosticism comes from. I mean, Bultmann is right up front. Okay, I don't have any evidence for Gnosticism existing before Christianity, but I stipulate that these Gnostics after Christianity have a tradition that goes back that began actually before Christianity. Well, in a sense, he's right. I mean, no one would argue that in a sense, in that any syncretistic religion is borrowing elements that have been around for a long time. I mean, arguably, it goes all the way back to Pythagoras, some of the most striking elements of it. But that's not Gnosticism. That's just an element that gets incorporated in Gnosticism. So yeah, some of the elements predate Christianity, but those are the elements that are not Christian. That predate Christianity and aren't in the New Testament either. Even if some of the vocabulary might actually make it into the New Testament, what the apostles mean and what the Pythagoreans would have meant or Plato would have meant or somebody else would have meant are two entirely different things. I mean, take something like dikaiosune. Plato talks about dikaiosune, but it doesn't mean the same thing Paul does. It's the same word, but he means justice. He means a pagan virtue by it. Paul is not talking about a moral virtue at all. He's talking, it's a completely different concept for Paul. So we have to be really careful. I mean, academics come along and snow you with this all the time that, well, Plato uses this word. So that somehow gives me permission to believe that Paul was influenced by Plato. Just because he uses the same word, we should know from our own experience that makes no sense. I mean, Jehovah's Witnesses use the same language, the same vocabulary that an Orthodox Christian would use, but they have different doctrines. When they talk about Jesus being the Son of God, they mean something very different than a Trinitarian means by that. It's the same word, but they've redefined it. They've given it a totally new content. Okay, let's see. So that took us into one of the issues, and that is the relationship between the New Testament and the Gnostics. I would contend there is absolutely no interaction, let alone influence. Not only is there no influence, there is no interaction in the New Testament with Gnosticism. They're not in dialogue with Gnostics. At the closest you get to that is Paul will sometimes enter into, like in the letters to the Corinthians, into dialogue with certain pagan ideas that are kind of quasi-Platonic ideas. But you don't ever have them in dialogue with Gnostics per se. Now that's a pretty controversial claim, because any commentary you pick up is going to have Colossians, 1 John especially, those two in particular, will say that this was written to combat the Gnostic heresy that John was confronting. And I just think they forgot to read and interpret the letter before they made that determination. They actually made that determination before they read the letter, not afterwards. That's in my humble opinion. Okay, and then... Well, no, I can. That, in particular, what they've decided in 1 John is that the issue that the Antichrist, the message of Antichrist, is that Christ, the denial that Christ came in the flesh. Now, that seems very plausible because if you look at any English translation, that's how it's going to translate it. Who is the Antichrist but the one who denies that Jesus came in the flesh? But the problem is that's in parallel with more often than not what John is saying in 1 John is in effect, not this language, but in effect, who is the Antichrist but the one who denies that Jesus is the Christ? Well, which is it? Are they denying that Christ came in the flesh, or are they denying that Jesus is the Christ? Well, you put all the clues in 1 John together, and I would argue, and it's that Jesus is the Christ. That's what they're denying. They're denying the Messiahship of Jesus. Those things that say, who is the Antichrist but the one who denies that Jesus came in the flesh, I think that's a mistranslation. Because if you look at the Greek syntax there, you could equally well translate it, who is the Antichrist but the one who denies that Jesus is the Christ coming in the flesh, that is, because he came in the flesh. The point being that apparently what these false teachers are objecting to is Jesus wasn't the Christ, he was a human being. He's a mere human being and therefore can't be the Christ. Very similar to the argument of Hebrews that objects to the Messiahship of Jesus on the grounds that he was a human being. So the reason people argue that that's Gnosticism is because they fast forward several hundred years into Christian history where it really was a debate, how can Jesus, who is the Christ, be a human being because God stuff has nothing to do with man stuff? You can't put them together. So he must not have actually been a human being. And some of them came up with a doctrine that's known as Docetism, where, yeah, he had the appearance of a human being, but there wasn't any human stuff around. It was just a divine being taking on the appearance. He seemed to be a human being, but he wasn't really a human being because divinity and humanity can't coexist in the same person. And so and Orthodoxy had to combat that by arguing that if they can't coexist in the same person, Orthodoxy had to combat that by saying, no, they can coexist in the same person. There's this really fine insulator that can keep the divinity and the humanity apart called the hypostatic union that allows them to be united in one person without intermingling, without mixing, without contaminating each other. So that's why they can exist in the same person. So what they do is they read John as basically making the case that Jesus was both human and divine in one person against these Docetists who were saying that he only appeared to be human, he wasn't really human. But the problem is that's about 200 years, 300 years out of sync. That wasn't a debate in the time of John when John is writing his letters, I would contend. But they equate that with Gnosticism because notice the only similarity even that has to Gnosticism is that the divine and the human are like matter and antimatter. They can't come into contact with each other. Which, okay, yeah, something like that is exactly along the lines of how Gnostics are thinking of the separation between the spiritual and the physical. They are like light and darkness, like good and evil, and they can't mix. But even that's not Gnosticism. I mean, even if John were combating that kind of idea, That idea is in Plato. That idea is in Neoplatonism. That idea is all over the ancient world at that time. It's not Gnosticism per se, because what makes Gnosticism Gnosticism is all this silly stuff that we talked about. I mean, without the silly stuff, you don't have Gnosticism. Yeah, the question was putting it on a timeline. I think one of the earliest is a guy named Cerinthus, and I don't know where to... I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you exactly. Maybe he's in the... what would that be, 2nd century? As early as the 2nd century. But most of them... Notice the anti-Gnostic fathers. What was the date I gave you on them? 170 to 220. That's when they're writing. And their primary preoccupation is to combat Gnosticism and defend Christianity against that. So third century is when it's in its heyday. So, you know, notice that's about 300 years past the time that that Paul is writing, for example. Well, 250 years past the time that Paul is writing. Okay. Anything else on Gnosticism? Let's see. I think I've said everything I wanted to say.
So I'm just trying to summarize this in a nutshell in my head. And so are you saying that the Roman Greek culture into which Christianity was taken and already preformed in their thought about how God's interact with humanity and all that stuff, that that Christianity goes in and the early church fathers try to, they have their debates about certain elements of Christianity because it's not a natural fit into their pre-existing ideas about how God's work. So you have debates about whether Jesus could be divine and fleshly, because that doesn't work in their thinking. And what's the other one? Is he equal with God, I think, is the other one. That one doesn't fit, because in their preconceived ideas, gods have different degrees. So it created these debates. Mm-hmm. And so they had to find a way to work this out. But they never thought to consult Judaism, whether or not Judaism could conceive of something of God, calling something God and being in a human form. They never consulted with Judaism if Judaism thought that was possible. They just assumed that their own culture couldn't conceive of it as possible, so they just used that as the conclusive.
Well, and it may not have been conclusive. I mean, like you say, there were debates trying to solve it in a variety of different ways, but the very question, I mean, some of the questions that they were asking, if they had contextualized it into Judaism, would not be questions that would even naturally arise
right.
in the context of Judaism.
Uh-huh.
But they do naturally arise in this other context, and so mm-hmm. they look for answers to them. But you could go back and to the apostles sitting around their campfire or something and explain the problem to them, and they'd go, what are you talking about? I mean, why are we having this debate? I mean, I don't understand the problem. It's not in Judaism that you get spirit and flesh that are like matter and antimatter
uh-huh.
with each other. That's not in Judaism or in the Bible. That's basically Pythagoreanism revitalized over and over and over again through the history of Hellenized culture.
So over all these a couple of thousand years now, we've had the writings of the New Testament handed down to us and interpreted, our Christianity interpreted, through the culture of Greek-Roman culture. and through, you know, sincere, I just want to assume, sincere intellectual people, but no one ever stopped to figure out, is this okay with Judaism? Would mm-hmm. Judaism say this?
And it might be helpful to read Justin Martyr somewhere along the line. Because, I mean, that seems odd when you put it that way, right? I mean, why? Jesus was a Jew. I mean, Paul was a Jew. Why didn't you think to find out what they were saying within the context of their own culture? But you read someone like Justin Martyr, something has happened, a shift has happened, where the Jews have become the enemy. We are Christians, we are not Jews. God is doing things through the church, through Christianity. He has stopped doing things through the Jews. They maybe used to been his chosen people, but they ain't no more. I mean, it basically is the perspective. So, and it results in an almost a kind of hostility, a kind of antagonism toward, and I think that must be historically and sociologically the genesis of that. I mean, it doesn't ever, I mean, why would I consult the Jews? I mean, they're the bad guys. Why would I consult them? Kind I think
the,
that's where
the
it comes
enemy
from.
They appear to be the enemies of God.
Yeah, exactly.
So they could not possibly have anything to contribute.
Yeah, I mean that's
or
probably
to enlighten anything that would be helpful.
Yeah, that's probably way too simplistic. But I'm just trying to account for what otherwise is really a pretty strange phenomenon: mm-hmm. is that there'd be such a radical break. There's a book I read by a Berkeley professor, Boyerin. That's not his name. But he's a Jew at Berkeley who writes extensively about the origins of Christianity. And basically he argues that there's a break about this time. And he gives his own account for why that was. Because he argues that within Judaism, the kind of idea that I think is the New Testament idea of Jesus being a man who is God, you know, a man who is the embodiment of everything that God is, was really quite at home in the Judaism of the New Testament era. But then Christianity takes one route and Judaism takes the other. The problem with that is, well, doesn't that leave room kind of for there being more than one God? I mean, doesn't it leave room for there being God and then another God? And he says, yeah, it did. And Christianity ran with that and made the Trinity, and came up with the Trinity. Judaism decided, if you're going that direction, we're going the other direction. And he saw it as kind of a mutual, almost a kind of mutual agreement that this is what's going to distinguish Christians from Jews, is Christians are going to develop the Trinitarian doctrine, Jews are going to resist it for all they're worth. They're purely monotheists and strictly monotheists. 2 minutes. Any final question? Do you have a feel for Gnosticism? Did that help? Gnosticism is what I forgot to say. And I don't know if this is true, but I've heard from different writers make the claim that Gnosticism almost won. That is, that the world, Western civilization, could have very easily have become Gnostic rather than Christian, because it wouldn't have taken too much. There was so much, Gnosticism was so popular at one point that it was almost like it was going to overwhelm Christianity and it would become the religion of choice rather than Christianity. And it's just kind of an accident of history that Christianity prevailed in that fight. Now, I don't have any independent judgment on that. That's the judgment of some historians.
Even if you don't look at it from being divinely moved, I'm just saying that people make judgments about what makes more sense and seems more real, and it doesn't sound like a way of thinking that would catch and continue for a very period of time. But mm-hmm. I can see how it might get popular for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've had a resurgence in interest in Gnosticism within the last 40 years. Elaine Pagels published and compiled what'd you call it?
The Nag Hammadi Library.
Yeah, the Nag Hammadi Library. And I think she had a book called The Gnostic Gospels, didn't she?
Yes.
And particularly in academic religious studies, it's become a resurgent interest. And I mean that, and there, and she's writing from the perspective not just academically, but as someone who thinks that the Gnostics have a lot of good things to teach us, and a lot of perspectives that we have forgotten that have been drowned out by Christianity, and we need to return to the important truths that the Gnostics had to teach us, that kind of thing. But I, well, yeah, I think she looks past the silliness factor and is looking at some moral values and perception of reality things. What Augustine liked about Manichaeism and liked about the Gnosticism that he believed in was, if everything comes from one, and this is really Neoplatonism too, if everything comes from one, even evil as well as good is somehow, it's all connected because the only being that has being is the one, and it all flows out of that. He liked the organic interconnectedness of that, that all of reality is interconnected in that way. You don't have this big gulf between creator and creation. I kind of like that gulf myself, but in Gnosticism, not really, no. It's not even, there's not even any particular moral demands in Gnosticism. It's all a matter of expedience. Do you want to get reabsorbed into the light or not? And here's what you have to know, and here's how you need to maintain that knowledge in order to achieve that or attain that. See, that there's another great example of the difference between Hellenistic religions and Judaism. Judaism is fundamentally and essentially moral in its demands, in the demands that God places on you. Not so much in any sort of Hellenistic religion. Even the most moral of them, take something like Stoicism. You're not answerable to anyone. The reason you live a moral life is out of a kind of expedience. Life will go better. It'll be smoother. You'll be better off if you live this way. But notice the pragmatic, expedient nature of that. That really the only system that I'm aware of that really brings in the divine imperative where you feel the full force of the oughtness of ought is out of Judaism and therefore Christianity. It was really jarring to me, and I'll stop with this, but it was really jarring to me the first time I read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, his work on ethics. Because I got 3/4 of the way through it and said, when is he going to get into ethics? There ain't no ought here. You know, I was reading this to find out what I ought to do, and there's nothing you ought to do. It's all about how do you get along better in Athens, living as a Greek in Athens. You know, how do you make it go better for you? And being trained a Christian all my life, I thought ethics was doing what you ought to do. And that was my first encounter with, wow, you mean some people don't even think in those terms. That's not how some people even conceive of ethics. I'll let you go. So we'll finish the Church Fathers next week.